Formosa Files is sponsored by the Frank C. Chen Cultural Foundation. Frank Chen, Chen Qichuan, served as the mayor of Kaohsiung City from 1960 to 1968 and founded the Kaohsiung Medical College.
Formosa Files.
Welcome to Formosa Files. I'm John Ross, and I'm talking to Chris Stowers, a photographer and writer who's been based in Taipei for many years. Hello, Chris.
Hi, John. Thanks for inviting me to record this, my very first podcast with you.
Today, we're going to look at the story of five Chinese men and one American. They were all living in Taiwan at the time, which was back in 1955. They went to the United States the hard way.
Yes, we could say they took the slow, scenic route. They sailed across the Pacific Ocean from Formosa to San Francisco and in an old Chinese junk called Free China.
And when I decided to cover this epic and heartwarming story, Chris, I thought you'd be the perfect person to help me out. You've made your own amazing long-distance voyage in a traditional sailing craft.
Well, to set the scene, the voyage I made was in 1988. I was a lot younger back then and a fair bit less wise. And instead of a Chinese junk, it was aboard a traditional wooden spice ship known as a prahu, built by the Bugis seafarers who inhabit the waters between South Sulawesi and Flores in the far east of Indonesia.
How big was this ship?
Oh, it was, looking back on it, it was actually pretty massive, 70 feet long. It weighed, we were told, 60 tons. So it's quite a thing to handle. Even getting the main anchor up, there were three anchors, but the main one was very big. It took five of us to pull the anchor up, so it needed a big crew. Mm-hmm. Well, fleets of these prahu, which, like the Free China, had no engine and, well, not much of anything, really. Certainly no life jackets or radio equipment or unnecessary stuff like that. Fleets of these prahu for centuries, until the late 1970s, in fact, took advantage of the trade winds that in September and October blow from Flores towards Singapore. In their holds, they carried exotic produce like bird's nests, mother of pearl, gold dust, sandalwood, and coffee, things that the populace of Singapore were anxious to get their hands on. They would dock in the Kallang River, close to where Bugis Street is today. In fact, it was named after them.
Ah, okay. Anyway, back in Flores, in Indonesia, in 1988, you've bumped into a bunch of five French adventurers and one Swiss. They were going to buy one of these boats and sail first to Singapore.
Yes, and then on to France. They were trying to get there in time for the bicentennial of the storming of the Bastille, which is in 1989, July 14th. Well, that was their hope, but they never made it in the end. So that's another story. I just needed to get to Singapore and didn't have any money, so I joined the crew. It was only after we finally set off that we realized that only one of us had ever sailed before. Luckily, that was the captain, Pascal. But we sort of picked it up as we went along. And so after a voyage of many hazards and mishaps, somehow we arrived at Changi Sailing Club as the elite members of that establishment were getting stuck into their afternoon gin and tonics.
Nice.
Yeah, thinking about it, there were actually a lot of similarities between our voyage on the good ship Konia Elahi, which means God bless when translated, and that of the crew of the Free China, though their adventure preceded ours by several decades.
Our story of the Free China junk is set in Taiwan in the 1950s. So let's have a little look at Taiwan then. It's poor, repressive, still recovering from the fallout of World War II, the destruction and the abrupt transition from Japanese colonial rule to rule under the Chinese nationalists. And it was still struggling to absorb the massive exodus, over a million refugees who had fled China following the communist victory in 1949.
There was martial law and the constant threat of Chinese invasion. Much of the nation's finances were spent on the military, much needed for the defense of the island and also that dream of returning to China.
Yes. For the mainlanders in Taiwan, there was homesickness. And little by little, year after year, the fading off that dream of returning home of going back to their villages and cities, back to their family and friends. But there was another destination of which these exiles dreamed, the United States of America. It stood alone as the world's most prosperous and powerful nation, and many of the finest talents and brains from China would move on from Taiwan to the US.
But getting there wasn't so easy, though. You needed permission to leave Taiwan and permission to enter the United States. And of course, if you didn't have any money or connections or luck or some other special reason, well, it might as well have been the far side of the moon.
Yes. Our story starts in the fall of 1954, which coincided with the start of the first cross-strait crisis, China attacking ROC-held islands near the Chinese coast. But back in the port city of Geelong, Paul Chow, or if we pronounce it properly, Paul Zhou, 28-year-old mainland Chinese refugee, a fisherman working in the FRA, Fisheries Rehabilitation Administration, that's the United Nations program to develop modern fisheries in Taiwan. He's getting itchy feet. One day he was reading the China Post.
And that's an English language newspaper, which indicates our man Paul Zhou was more educated than you'd expect for a fisherman.
Yes, he was from an educated family, but like many, his education had been interrupted. His father was a government railroad manager, and throughout his childhood, Paul's family moved around following the father's career.
And fleeing the advancing Japanese.
Yes, and he actually quit high school to go and join the fight against the Japanese. After the Second World War, he joined a program, this fisheries program, administered by the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. So this Fisheries Rehabilitation Administration, established in early 1946 to rebuild China's war-torn fishing industry, I think perhaps 200 diesel fishing boats, mostly from America, but some too from my home country of New Zealand, were sent to China. Now, the local Chinese fishermen had to be trained before they could take over these motorized boats. So some of the original crew who'd brought the boats over, they stayed on and they trained some Chinese. So an interpreter was put on each vessel. Paul Zhou's language skills got him the job of interpreter. But 6 months later, the training finished. He had to start as a fishing hand, as an apprentice. But 3 years later, he'd become captain of a fishing boat. Going back to that fateful day in Geelong, Paul Zhou is reading his newspaper, the China Post. He's in his apartment, which he shares with his fisherman workmates.
Yes, and he notices an interesting announcement in a corner on the last page. It's a wire piece from the New York Herald Tribune. And the announcement says, in commemoration of the 125th anniversary of the Royal Swedish Yacht Club, the New York Yacht Club announces that it will jointly sponsor a transatlantic yacht race with the Swedes next summer. The race will start from Newport, Rhode Island, on the 11th of June, 1955, and finish in Gothenburg, Sweden, for a gala celebration.
Newport, Rhode Island, that's on the east coast of the US between New York City and Boston. Now, it's strange that the announcement would catch Paul's eye, because he's never been on a yacht, not been sailing. There's no tradition of sailing as a sport in China, and he's much too poor to be thinking about this rich man's sport.
Yeah, but he does think something. He's wondering about Chinese fishing junks. He asks himself, in the rough seas of the North Atlantic, could a junk beat those yachts?
Rather odd idea, no?
Right. There was an incident a couple of years earlier which had made a deep impression on Paul. At that time, he was on a modern fishing boat and they were caught in a storm making a run for shelter. But sailing abreast of them was a junk, a traditional junk, and that was heading in for the same sheltered cove. Cho's vessel was making full use of its 300 horsepower diesel engine. But at the same time, the two-masted junk, by comparison, with just two shabby sails, and it looked like they were kind of patched up with flour sacks and stitched together, it was racing alongside them through the stormy seas. But when Joe's fishing boat reached shelter, he discovered that the junk had already arrived. The sails were taken in and the crew were cleaning the deck. They were probably brewing up some tea as well.
Yes, impressive. And in the years After that, Paul Zhou had fished alongside these junks. He had towed disabled diesel boats out of storms, but not junks. He'd never had to help a junk. So, he's thinking, maybe a junk could perform well against a yacht. But as I think more, no, he's talking about coastal sailing, not ocean crossings.
Yeah, a big difference between following the coastline and cutting across an unpredictable ocean. But Chow is thinking about this international yacht race from America to Sweden the following year. Could he enter a Chinese junk in this transatlantic race? And he voices this thought out loud. Will they let a junk join this yacht race?
In Joe's excellent book, The Junk That Challenged the Yachts, published in 2011, he describes the scene. Quote, all the heads in the apartment turned around and gave me a funny look. No one made any comment, though. A little while later, a voice broke the silence. Why don't you ask them? Who? I asked. Those who sponsor the race, said Reno. End quote. Reno was a fellow fisherman who would end up on the Free China junk voyage.
So Paul Zhou wrote a letter. He didn't have an address.
Remind me, who's sponsoring the race?
Well, it was co-sponsored by the New York Yacht Club, the Royal Swedish Yacht Club, and the Royal Yacht Club of Gothenburg. The competition, the first of its kind since 1935, was to take place on June 11th, 1955. So Cho addressed his letter to the New York Yacht Club, care of New York Herald Tribune, New York City, USA.
The weeks passed, then 2 months, then out of the blue, a telegram.
It had taken some time, but the letter to the Herald Tribune had found its way to the race organizers, and they thought it important enough to send a telegram.
The telegram read, quote, we are glad to accept your junk to the race. You are assigned racing number 320. Details and letter to follow.
Well, I don't want to be the one pouring cold water on this dream, but Joe didn't have a junk. and I don't think he had a friend with one. And he didn't have any money to buy one. He didn't have a crew.
Not just that, but he didn't know how to sail a junk.
Oh, I know that feeling. But he's an experienced sailor in motorized boats, but not sailing ones. And then there were the visa difficulties. Permission to leave Taiwan and permission to enter the United States, this is all very difficult.
Yeah, and before talking about visas, passports are needed, right? At that time, you needed to be on official business or a university student to get a passport, not something a regular citizen could get easily.
So he's got to find a boat, money to buy it, and get a crew. And he doesn't have that much time to do it.
And the fact they sent a telegram is an indication of the rush. Mm. It's November now, and the race starts in, when did you say?
June.
June. That's right,
so they got like 7 months or so to organize everything. It's got a lot of hurdles to overcome. But take things one step at a time. The main thing, find a junk.
This proved much harder than you would expect and what he expected. So, Chris, was it easy finding your God Bless?
My ship, the God Bless. Well, the French had already found God Bless by the time I joined the venture. So I didn't, you know, have that problem. But we still had to sail the boat back to the Bugis homeland, which is a small island called Jompia Island. You can hardly see it on the map. And it's about 3 days at sea from Flores, from the north coast of Flores to get there. And we needed to go there because we still had to complete negotiations to buy her from her owner, Mr. Souder, who's one of the headmen of the village. For that purpose, the French had already exchanged all their hard currency, which is quite a lot at the time. It was about $5,000. But that translated into huge piles of grubby, low-denomination Indonesian rupiah that filled two great big plastic sacks.
Wow.
Carrying all this cash with us, you know. No banks on the island, of course.
And back in Taiwan in 1954, Paul is hunting for a junk. Has he got money to buy one?
He had his own personal savings, which amounted to about $850, not bad. It was a reasonable amount, but even then, not a lot for buying a good boat. But who knows, should a few unwanted junks with owners in need of cash pop up, he was their man. Speaking of cash, an interesting detail is that his savings weren't in cash or even in a bank account. He says the money was in silver dollars and small gold coins.
Yeah, this is 1954, and Chinese people had been burned over the previous decade by hyperinflation. You know, in Taiwan, the Chinese currency had replaced the Japanese yen, and then the new Taiwan dollar had been introduced in 1949. Inflation had been brought down, but the trauma of having lost a life savings of, you know, a lifetime's work, it had scarred people.
I can imagine. Well, Cho, he searched the beaches and the rivers in the north and looking for, you know, telltale masts, and he only found one junk, and it was sitting high in the Danshui River, and it had a sign on it.
For sale.
No, the sign read, "The Floating Tea House." This junk was in a dilapidated state, no longer in a floating condition. So he headed home in a dejected mood.
He headed back to Taipei City, but too late for the last train to Geelong, so he stayed at a friend's house.
This is actually against the martial law rules of the time, which are pretty strict. If you spent a night away from your residence, you had to inform the police.
As luck would have it, his friend's house was subject to a random police check. Mm. Yes, they would just turn up unannounced and search people's homes. Paul spent the night in jail, and then come the next morning, he spouted some anti-communist platitudes to the judge. I think he paid a fine and was allowed to go home.
So he gets back home, having bad-mouthed the commies. No boat, no leads for finding one, but he decides to get a crew before he resumes his search, reasoning that a crew will mean more hands looking for a junk. Getting a crew turned out to be the easiest part of the Free China adventure. His fishing buddies, all four of his flatmates, all of them 28 years old. And there was another guy, 2 years older, aged 30, who went by the nickname Hulu.
All these guys were from various parts of China. They'd met in Shanghai post-World War II, joined that United Nations-sponsored fishing program, and they'd all been stranded for various reasons in Taiwan. He and his friends, fellow fishermen in the FRA, the Fisheries Rehabilitation Administration, most of them had risen to the rank of ship captain, but they're currently without fishing duties.
The search for a junk would eventually be helped by publicity. The newspapers found out about it, but Joe resisted talking to reporters.
Quoting from his book, oh, I love this. Quote, "My mother had told me to avoid four kinds of people, lawyers, politicians, newspaper reporters, and prostitutes."
Yeah, probably in that order too. Lawyers, politicians, newspaper reporters, and prostitutes. Interesting. He's going to get a lot of help from two of those categories.
People heard about their adventure and were willing to help. Someone contacted the mayor to contact a Navy guy to get them to the frontline islands, the Dachen Islands. There were some junks there, reportedly, but it was a military area off limits to civilians.
Joe and his friend Hulu headed off across the strait in a Navy vessel, an LSM, or land shipping medium, a bit like a landing craft. These were amphibious assault ships built in the last years of the Pacific War, used by the US Navy to land tanks and troops.
But before they reached Dachen, the communists launched a bombardment on January 10th. 8 days later, communist forces launched a successful air amphibious land operation to occupy Yijiangshan Island. It's approximately 9 miles north of Dachen, inflicting heavy casualties on the roughly 1,000 nationalist defenders on the ROC's northernmost island outpost.
Wow. So almost forgotten about part of history. Mm. So they were in this LSM landing craft. It's not a combat ship. So they didn't luckily have to take part in the battle, but they stood by for helping out with possible evacuation. The nationalist troops had signed a blood pledge to fight the enemy to the end, a human sacrifice, Chiang Kai-shek wanting to show nationalist resolve. The outcome was a heroic last stand to galvanize the people on Taiwan and also to help move American public opinion or government opinion.
The government in Taiwan declared that all 720 ROC troops had sacrificed their lives. The PRC numbers were that 500 ROC soldiers were killed and another 500 captured. But anyway, there's no one to evacuate from the island.
So it was a pretty bleak journey home after all that. Paul Joe says in his book that there was not a single word exchanged between Hulu and him on that homeward leg. The sadness of Ji Jian Shan and their own problems in getting a boat sort of overwhelmed them, I think.
As they entered Geelong Harbour, Hulu expressed his sympathy to his buddy and said, we best get back to fishing. The dream's over.
Paul didn't answer. As the landing craft moved in closer into the Navy pier, they noticed a pair of masts sticking out from behind some warehouses. Ship's masts. Could they be junk masts? They went to investigate. And yes, it was a junk, about 24 metres in total length, so what, 70 feet. It was rather the same length as my boat, the God Bless, actually. And there's an old guy on board, but there was a communication problem. He's speaking Taiwanese. So they had to go and find someone who spoke both Taiwanese and Mandarin to act as an interpreter.
Yeah, here you have individuals from China unable to communicate. It's a reminder that what we today call Chinese or Mandarin, Mandarin Chinese, it was far from being the universal language that everyone knew.
Indeed. With an interpreter in tow, Paul and Hulu learned that the junk arrived with a shipload of salt fish from Fuzhou. It had pulled in just a few days ago. And the old man was not the owner. He was the captain. The owner, a Mr. Lian, had gone into Geelong town to look for buyers for his cargo as soon as they had arrived, and he'd not been seen since then.
So they ask, when's he going to be back?
And the answer is, don't know, he's a big gambler. Gambling was illegal in Taiwan, wasn't it?
I think so, though this is the cardinal Chinese vice that can never be stamped out. It would be like keeping us Westerners away from the bottle. Anyway, Paul is in a hurry and doesn't want to wait. He goes searching through various gambling dens and finds the owner. The owner hadn't slept properly for days and had been losing badly. He's in a bad temper. He's been gambling away his cargo of salted fish and at a low price.
So Joe offers to buy his junk. It's a timely offer. The price he wants is 40,000 new Taiwan dollars and no bargaining. 40,000 Taiwan dollars was equivalent at that time to $1,000 US, more than Joe had, right?
Right. He's got $850, but Joe agrees to the price, but he'll need to find $150 and quickly.
Yeah, actually, he needs to find more than that because he needs money to refit the junk as well as buy it. And you've got to refit it for ocean going, so it has to be in good shape. You need a lot of spare ropes and such. And then there was paperwork and, of course, provisions for a long voyage like that all the way to America.
Right. And to give some context to these prices, his monthly pay was $30 a month.
Yeah. Wow. That's going to take some time. But desperate times call for desperate measures. He tells his shipmates to pawn anything they have of value.
Do they have anything of value to pawn?
No, nothing. But Hulu had he had some savings and he lent him the difference.
The next morning, the Central News newspaper ran a piece on Joe and Hulu's trip to Dacheng and the accidental discovery of the junk. And good journalism work here. They noted the men were still 6,000 NT dollars short. This might bring in some help.
So much for his mother's advice to avoid journalists.
And politicians too, because next he gets a message to see the mayor of Geelong. And he says, I heard that you're short of money. I'll give you 20,000 NT if you call your junk City of Geelong.
Well, the owner of the junk had also heard the news and figured he could get greedy. So when Joe turned up with 40,000 NT in cash, the owner said, the price is now 46,000. And Joe had to reluctantly pay up.
And then there was another momentary blow. The mayor was asking to see him. He goes to his office and he told Paul Joe, sorry, withdrawing my pledge. And of course, Paul was speechless.
But there's a good reason the mayor has dropped the sponsorship offer. The governor of Taiwan, which I'm pretty sure is a political office we no longer have here, he wanted to fund the project instead. So the government would pay for the junk and the men can use their money for supplies.
Right. The governor, his name was Yan Jiagan. He sort of pops up in Taiwan history all the time, like a Forrest Gump. Yeah.
You and Eric did an episode on him a while back, I believe.
That's right. An episode titled The Forgotten President. But his presidency is 2 decades in the future. Right now, he's offering money, and his only request is that the junk be called Free China.
Oh, that's a resounding name, isn't it? Free China. A name Taiwan was sometimes known by in the West, Free China, in contrast to Red China. So anyway, who owns the boat, the government or Paul?
Actually, the governor contributed 45,000 NT dollars, leaving Paul to pay the remaining 1,000 so that he could hold the title.
So he, Paul, is the owner and he holds the title, but he'll also own any of the difficulties that arise.
And oh my, there will be difficulties and dramas aplenty, triumphs and humiliations. But we've run out of time today, so we'll have to tell those stories next time. Thanks, Chris. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, John. It's bringing up old memories for me, actually.
Yeah, we'll find out what happened to you as well next
episode. Well, I survived, obviously. But
okay. All right. Bye everyone. Now.